especially in the media system in the U.S.
Well, the problem is that the stuff that is common.
I have your ears, and while I have your attention, right now shit in the world is fucked up, and I don't like that shit, and I know you don't either. So do yourself a favor, do me a favor, do everyone a favor, vote that motherfucker out of the fucking office. Please, please, please. I do not want to have children and have them grow up under that motherfucker's regime. Fuck that. For real. Listen, I got a couple more I want to drop on you if you guys are down. We need some revolutionary motherfuckers out there if you're down, people.
Less conversation, a little more action, please. All this aggravation ain't satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less bark. A little less fight, a little more spark. Close your mouth and open up your heart, and baby, satisfy me. Satisfy me, baby.
Elvis was a hero to most, but Elvis was a hero to most. Elvis was a hero to most, but he never meant to me. You see, straight out racist, the sucker was simple and plain.
Motherfucking men, John Wayne.
Cause I'm black and I'm proud.
Already
I'm hyped cause I'm amped. Most of my heroes don't appear in no stamp. Sample, look at you looking for nothing but rednecks for 400 years if you check.
Don't worry, be happy.
Was a number one jam. Damn, if I said you could slap me right here. Get it.
Let's get this party started right.
Right on.
Come on.
What we got to say.
Okay, let's see. We all know who that is in the background. Public Enemy. And this is Hassan, and this is the 6 p.m. Friday news. Thanks for listening. Remember, Kill Radio can save your life. Our phone number is 213-252-0998. And that was Z-Trip, who opened the show for me here, talking about he didn't want his kids growing up under this regime. And there's something that happened this week that was so depressing here in Los Angeles that I'm not even going to read any articles out of the LA Times about it, because I normally do read from the LA Times because I like that paper. I have friends that write for it. But it was just a depressing article because the policeman who beat up an unarmed motorist last year got off today. And it's interesting because this is an election year, so it's going to... Even the police chief said this isn't over yet because he's on the side of the mayor. And the mayor is reaching out to the black community, so it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Okay. So, anyway, yeah. A guy, they said, was stealing a car last year, and the police chased him, like almost like with Rodney King. He ran, and they beat the shit out of him when they caught him. He didn't have any weapons. Another cop said he heard another cop holler gun, but the witnesses said they'd never heard any cops holler gun. So this one cop said that was the emphasis he needed to like beat this guy almost to a pulp. And they said, now people, listen to this. This is the weirdest piece of legal regal I ever heard. They said the reason why they had to let this cop go today is because the man who was beat up wasn't beat up bad enough. They said he only had wounds or cuts that literally, I quote you not, quote unquote, he only had wounds and cuts that Motrin or an over-the-counter drug could cure, Advil. And that's why they couldn't fire these cops or, you know, well, in all honesty to everybody, this guy, even though he's in jail right now, he's doing a year for stealing cars for what happened that night, but he's suing the city for $3 million. He'll probably get $1 million. And but again, this is an election year, so it's going to be interesting to see what happens. So, you know, let's go back into Z-Trip. He's sampling everybody here from Public Enemy to a lot of other people. And then we're going to go into a piece I stole off of NPR last week about these Uncle Tom chitlin-eating black preachers who are supporting George Bush. excuse my vernacular, but I don't know. Black people who support George Bush, that's, to me, I don't understand that. Black Republicans, it's like, you know, gay Republicans. I just don't, you know, the Republican Party does not like gay people. It has, it can't stand, it just uses black people. You know, people say the Democratic Party does that, but the Republican Party is even worse because they'll put them out there just to recruit. There's all, like at the Republican convention, there's always more people of color on the stand up front on the podium than there is in the audience. Just check it out. But again, I lost my train of thought here. We're going to, what was I talking about? I lost my train of thought. What we're going to do, we're going to go back into Z-Trip, and then we're going to go into, oh, the Black Preachers. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. The Black Preachers. After Z-Trip goes off, we're going to go into an interview they did on NPR about this meeting they had out here in Los Angeles last week with Black Preachers, and the Black Preachers who support George Bush, which to me is so disgusting. It's so disgusting. It's a personal affront to me. It doesn't bother a lot of black people, so I guess, you know, I'm black, but it bothers the fuck out of me, you know, because, again, I repeat, you know, I'm not embarrassed to say I'm a Democrat. My grandfather was a Democrat, you know. I mean, we're two totally different Democratic people. I mean, I'm so far to the left of the Democratic Party that the Democratic Party is embarrassed to admit that I exist, okay. But I'm a Democrat. I'm not a Green. Or even though I registered Peace and Freedom in high school in the early 70s, I'm telling you how old I am. But, you know, the Republican Party does not like gay people, and it uses black people. So that's that. So, again, let's go into Z-Trip, and then we're going to go into this article about the black preachers who support Bush. And, again, this is the Cure Radio News. CureRadio.org. Remember, Cure Radio just might save your life. Let's see. Wait a minute. Let's see.
Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Is it really worth it in this day and age to end up the winners of a World War III? Think about it. Once we take over that place, we'll never, ever be able to leave. Somehow we think we're gonna waltz right in to colonize their hearts and minds. But the Arab people are now so damn mad, we'll be lucky to get out of there alive. You think any of them want their kings to sell us oil? Think of the cost to keep our army there. When the only way left to bleed oil out of the ground is soldiers' guns treating Arabs like slaves. Or was that all part of the plan?
Yo, if you die for peace, let me see a peace sign.
America the Beautiful is going to hell. We no longer make cars or TVs very well. Our economy's rigged on selling guns and making war. What happens when no one wants our products anymore? Got one thing left to sell. That's the world police. A mercenary state to ensure there's no peace. New World Order Mafia, with them still in charge. What kind of a Bush League double cross is this? Can those rah-rah we love war polls be believed when so many of us everywhere are out in the streets? Pentagon Parrot Papers won't admit we exist. What that says to me is their owners are scared that we will get as strong as they have in Berlin and tear down their walls and their new order scams. Yellow ribbon McCarthyism can't hold us too long. We support our troops most 'cause we say, bring them home! Bring them home!
Trip is talking about. Make some motherfucking noise.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Everybody look what's going down.
And particularly to mobilize to try and defeat efforts to make same-sex marriage or domestic partnerships more available. To talk with us about this political organizing effort and about how African-American ministers in some of the more conservative denominations and churches are becoming more closely aligned with President Bush. He is a frequent guest on Air Talk, Joe Hicks, Vice President of Community Advocates, Inc., a non-traditional, non-profit, civil, and human rights organization. Joe, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Larry.
Well, let's talk about the efforts to reach out on the part of the Bush administration to these conservative black churches. How much of an effort do you think was required, or how much of a natural affinity is there already among these pastors and their congregants toward the president?
Well, I think there is a natural affinity. Clearly, the black community socially has been conservative, which is not reflected in the leadership, generally speaking, of people like Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, who have always aligned themselves with America's left and feminist and other kinds of forces. But there has been an ongoing streak, if you will, trend within black voting indicates that in terms of social issues, the black community generally is conservative. That's also reflected in the vast majority of America's black pastors, who are also socially conservative on issues like, you know, gay marriage issues and others. So I think there is a natural affinity. The Bush administration, in fact, President Bush very early on attempted to reach out and has been fairly consistent in that. And we see that reflected in the gains made at this past election, where they garnered something like 11% of the black vote, up from 8% in the year 2000. So progress is being made, and I think it, frankly, it's good for democracy. It's good for ideological diversity in the black community. I think it's a positive trend.
Well, and what do you think about those who would say that these pastors, in their effort to see more socially conservative laws passed or even constitutional amendments, are, and I put this in quotation marks, selling out other interests of the black community, like affirmative action, more funding for inner city programs, traditional democratic kinds of base issues?
Well, the presumption, of course, is that those are good for the black community. There obviously is contention over how much those kind of programs act in the interest of America's black population. And I think it's really a disservice and very insulting to claim that people that simply look for other options politically and look for other answers to ongoing problems are somehow selling out. They used to really deter people looking for other alternatives. I think it just kind of hit the wall.
Well, and I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah,
I was going to ask, do you think that the fact that there are significant numbers, it would appear, of these socially conservative pastors who are embracing the Republican Party and the president's agenda, does that in some sense offer more cover to African-American Republicans to be more open about their politics?
Oh, yes, I think it will. I think it will encourage others to be more open about you know, them exploring other options. So I think there's a lot that's positive. Whether or not one certainly goes where these ministers are going in terms of gay marriage issues and other so-called moral issues, what I find positive is simply the fact that there is a growing independence in the black community politically, which I think is a good thing. It you know, the fact that the black community has voted upwards of 90% for Democratic candidates over the last decade or so, it really has to be looked at and examined for what it is. And some would claim that that simply is not a good thing.
What do you think, Joe, about what appears to be a more close alignment between black conservative churches and those that are evangelical or Pentecostal and white churches of the same theology? It seems that there was a great deal of segregation and separation historically. It does appear that there is more of a coming together interracially when there is an agreement on theology. Do you see that?
Yes. Well, I think that's the natural kind of a common ground that is shared there. And I think that these so-called white ultra-right churches, if one can use that kind of terminology, have sort of begun to shed over a number of years this perception that they were somehow in bed with segregationist views. That, of course, is not where they are today. And you see this sort of growing common ground around these issues that there's certainly a natural affinity around. So there's simply a coalescing of forces around issues that are natural, I think, for both of these religious groupings.
Now, where does this leave, for example, the African Methodist Episcopal churches that have been traditionally very liberal on social issues and very activist-oriented? Is there a polarization potentially in the religious black community as a result of this movement?
Well, certainly some of the more liberal pastors heading churches like that will probably engage in some of behind the scenes, of course, will engage in some name-calling, perhaps, and would, in fact, perhaps look at some of these ministers as sellouts of sorts. But again, as indicated before, that just doesn't work these days. I think there's a view that they're pushing forward in their own agenda. There's certainly a growing strength in numbers, and which I think will encourage others to move in that direction. So we have to see where this goes. This is going to be an incremental process. It's going to be no full tilt rush toward the Republican Party. And those who think that's going to happen, I think, are deluding themselves. This is a slow, incremental process.
All right, Joe Hicks, thank you very much for being with us. Appreciate your time. We'll continue a conversation on this topic in greater depth, looking at what's at stake politically and also what it indicates about the greater organization and mobilization of conservative black churches. Thanks, Joe.
You're welcome.
Joe Hicks, Vice President of Community Advocates, Inc., a non-traditional,
I
nonprofit,
wanna say is,
civil and human
mandate
rights.
Mandate my ass. Because it seems as though we've been convinced that 26% of the registered voters, not even 26% of the American people, but 26% of the registered voters form a mandate or a landslide. 21% voted for Skippy and 3-4% voted for somebody else who might have been running. But oh yeah, I remember in this year that we have now declared the year from Shogun to Reagan, I remember what I said about Reagan. Minute. Acted like an actor. Hollywood. Acted like a liberal, acted like General Franco when he acted like governor of California, then he acted like a Republican, then he acted like somebody was going to vote for him for president. And now we act like 26% of the registered voters is actually a mandate. We're all actors in this, I suppose. What has happened is that in the last 20 years, America has changed from a producer to a consumer. And all consumers know that when the producer names the tune, the consumer has got to dance. That's the way it is. We used to be a producer, very inflexible at that, and now we are consumers and finding it difficult to understand. Natural resources and minerals will change your world. The Arabs used to be in the third world. They have bought the second world and put a firm down payment on the first one. Controlling your resources will control your world. This country has been surprised by the way the world looks now. They don't know if they want to be Matt Dillon or Bob Dylan. They don't know if they want to be diplomats or continue the same policy of nuclear nightmare diplomacy. John Foster Dulles ain't nothing but the name of an airport now. The idea concerns the fact that this country wants nostalgia. They want to go back as far as they can, even if it's only as far as last week. Not to face now or tomorrow, but to face backwards. And yesterday was the day of our cinema heroes riding to the rescue at the last possible moment. The day of the man in the white hat or the man on the white horse. or the man who always came to save America at the last moment. Someone always came to save America at the last moment, especially in B-movies. And when America found itself having a hard time facing the future, they looked for people like John Wayne. But since John Wayne was no longer available, they settled for Ronald Reagan. And it has placed us in a situation that we can only look at like a B-movie. Come with us back to those inglorious days when heroes weren't zeros, before fair was square, when the cavalry came straight away and all American men were like Hemingway, to the days of the wondrous B-movie. The producer, underwritten by all the millionaires necessary, will be Casper the Defensive Weinberger. No more animated a choice is available. The director will be Attila the Hague, running around frantically declaring himself in control and in charge. The ultimate realization of the inmates taking over at the asylum. The screenplay will be adapted from the book called Voodoo Economics by George Papadoc Bush. Music by the village people, the very military, macho man. Theme song for saber rattling and selling wars door to door. Remember, we're looking for the closest thing we can find to John Wayne. Cliches abound like kangaroos, courtesy of some spaced out Marlon Perkins, a Reagan contemporary. Cliches like itchy trigger finger and tall in the saddle and riding off or on into the sunset. Cliches like get off of my planet by sundown. More so than cliches like he died with his boots on. Marine tough to man is, Bogart tough to man is, Cagney tough to man is, Hollywood tough to man is, cheap steak tough, and Bonzo substantial. The ultimate in synthetic selling, a Madison Avenue masterpiece, a miracle, a cotton candy politician, presto macho. Macho, macho. Put your orders in America, and quick as Kodak, your leaders duplicate with the accent being on the dupes. Because all of a sudden we have fallen prey to selective amnesia, remembering what we want to remember and forgetting what we choose to forget. All of a sudden the man who called for a bloodbath on our college campuses is supposed to be Dudley goddamn Do-Right. You go give them liberals hell, Ronnie. That was the mandate to the new Captain Bly on the new ship of fools. It was doubtlessly based on his chameleon performance in the past as a liberal Democrat, as the head of the Studio Actors Guild, when other celluloid saviors were cringing in terror from McCarthy, Ron stood tall. It goes all the way back from Hollywood to Hillbilly, from liberal to libelous, from Bonzo to Birchite or Born Again. Civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, it's all wrong. Call in the cavalry.
Let's see. Thank you, Brother Gil Scott Heron, in the background there. Brother Gil Scott Heron, and let's see what I'm going to do right now, you guys. I'm going to this is the Kill Radio 6 p.m. Friday news. I'm Hassan, killradio.org, and again, that was Gil Scott Heron doing the famous B movies about our ex president Uncle Ronnie. Let's see. I'm going to try and read this whole article, but chances are I'll break it up and read the next part next week or the week after next, but I will finish it. It's a great article here in the on the front of the LA Times yesterday, LA Times, Thursday, February 3rd, 2005, the Los Angeles Times, about overcrowding at the LA County Jail, which is the second largest jail in the country, second largest municipal jail. Scary place. There's been a couple murders there. It's the kind of jail that you saw in the movie American Me. And let's see. But later on, I think I'm just going to read half of this article because it's kind of long, but it's interesting. And then later on in the show, I'm going to end the show with a little teaser for you guys. I stole a great interview with James Brown of NPR last week, off of the local NPR station here in Los Angeles, up at Pasadena College. Great article with James Brown and his new wife, and they're doing all right. James's voice is getting a little graspy, but, you know, the hardest working man in show business. And I'm going to play that article, that interview, in its entirety on my jazz show. I do a jazz show here at Kill Radio every Monday night at midnight. James Brown has a new book out about himself, and he's touring around the world talking about it. You know, I'm a big fan of James Brown, huge fan, you know. Huge. The only thing I didn't like about the interview, they didn't ask him too much about his influence in Africa, because they love James Brown in Africa. They love him. They mob him whenever he goes there, and it's been that way since the late 60s, and they didn't ask him about that. But his life is just so rich and full of other things. He was abandoned by his mother when he was like 8. His great aunt raised him. Let's see. Oh, yes, and we lost a great artist today, I understand, in New York. Great actor, writer, great playwright, too. Ozzie Davis left the planet, passed away. Ozzie, you've given me a lot of great moments, a lot, from your play Pearly. I don't want to make a fool of myself, but I'm more than sure you wrote that great play, introduced a lot of actors to the world. Ozzie Davis, he passed away today in New York. He died today in New York. And we all will die one day. Okay, and again, I want to thank Ozzie Davis' family for giving us Ozzie for all these great years of entertainment in the theater, international theater. And New York was lucky. That's where you lived, Ozzie, and that's where they got to see you the most, see your work from when you were a young man. For those of you who don't remember Ozzie Davis, he played... the mayor in Spike Lee's movie. The movie Spike Lee made about the pizza place in New York. And that's how a lot of the world found out about Ozzie Davis. But I knew about him when I was a really young man. I used to read his plays, look at his movies. But Spike Lee actually brought him to the forefront. And I rent that film. I forgot the name of it. Do the Right Thing. Do the Right Thing. Yeah, he plays Damare, the old man, the Damare Harlem. Damare, D-A. Okay, and then let's see. After I read this article in the LA Times, we're going to go into play a little Mumia Abu-Jamal. We always try and play some of him here because his great producer, Noel Hanrahan, always sends us his stuff, and we're going to play a little of him. And then we're going to end the news today with this little bit of... I'm going to give you guys a little tidbit of this James Brown interview. But to hear the whole thing, you're going to have to tune into my jazz show on Monday night at midnight, this Monday, coming up. Okay? And I'm sure it'll be archived, too, pretty soon, and you can download it anytime. Again, this is Hassan. This is the Friday 6 p.m. Kill Radio News, and I'm going to read this article from the LA Times... LA Times yesterday. It's entitled LA Jail Called Deadly, Outdated, by Jack Leonard and Richard Winton, Times staff writers. And this is on the front page. Los Angeles County's largest jail is so outdated, understaffed, and riddled with security flaws that it jeopardizes the lives of guards and inmates. The county's expert on the jail system concluded in a confidential report recommending that the facility be closed. Special Counsel Merrick Bobb sharply criticized Men's Central Jail in downtown Los Angeles for failing to prevent dangerous inmates from being housed with lower risk inmates and said the cell block's design ensured that any response to an inmate takeover would be extraordinarily bloody. The 6,338-bed jail, the largest in the country, is nightmarish to manage and suffers from lax supervision and a long-standing jail culture that has shortchanged accountability for inmate safety and security, Bob said, quote-unquote. The Board of Supervisors ordered the report, obtained by the Times after inmates killed 5 fellow inmates in county jails between October 2003 and April 2004. 4 of the slayings occurred at the Men's Central, one of 6 jails housing 18,495 inmates total that the county operates. Okay, see jail page 24. Okay, sit tight, White. Hear the paper rattling in the background. Okay, Bob's is the most critical of several recent inquiries into the jail system, all of which have called for security improvements. Even after the slaying in Men's Central, Bob said, deputies continue to seriously err in classifying inmates and deciding where to house them. The supervisors who received the confidential report in November have not discussed it in public, but two said Wednesday that it had spurred them to question Sheriff Lee Baca about whether he could move some inmates from Men's Central to more secure facilities. Bob called for the massive lockup to be phased out and replaced with new, smaller jails, a move that Baca called unrealistic, saying it would cost the financially strapped county nearly $1 billion. Other jails around the country already use more sophisticated systems to house and control inmates, Bob wrote. In the meantime, he urged the county board to take immediate steps to make Men's Central safer. Among his major recommendations, Bob said the jail should overhaul how it decides where to house inmates and dramatically increase the number of sheriff's deputies at the facility, which has one of the worst staff-to-staff ratios in the country. The jail has one staff member for about every 10 inmates, while the national average is one for every 4.3 inmates. The report also paints a chilling scenario of what could happen without improvements. Calling an inmate takeover more than a remote possibility, Bob wrote it would be nearly impossible to quell without the spilling of so much blood as to be morally, pragmatically, and politically indefensible. A Los Angeles lawyer who specializes in police practices, Bob declined to comment on the report, citing attorney-client privilege. Baca said he could not comment on the document for the same reason. He acknowledged that the jail had security flaws and was understaffed, but called an inmate takeover highly unlikely, quote-unquote. The four-story jail's design allows units to be shut down individually, reducing the likelihood of mass violence, he said. Even when we had disturbances in the gang modules between the Bloods and the Crips in the 1980s, Sheriff Baca said, we were able to quickly move in. In 1985, inmates armed themselves with broom handles and other makeshift weapons in an uprising that was put down by a team of armed deputies, injuring 13 deputies and 40 inmates. Refurbishment planned. Let me see how much more time I got here. Okay. I'm going to try and finish this, guys. Refurbishment planned. Baca said he planned to refurbish Men's Central by adding security cameras and upgrading locks on doors. He is also weighing whether to replace bars on the front of each cell with doors to prevent inmates from passing messages and weapons back and forth. The central jail needs a dusting and cleaning and retrofitting, but its basic design is cost-effective, he said. In his report, Bob applauded efforts by the department to correct security flaws immediately after the spat of killings. Baca noted that there had been no killings since the summer, when the county allocated $7.5 million to improve the frequency with which deputies search individual cells at the jail. The difficulty is that we're woefully understaffed, he said. The board knows this. I know this. The sheriff said it was not feasible to demolish Men's Central and build newer jails, given the county's financial problems. He has repeatedly lobbied for money to reopen jails with a total of about 4,000 beds that have been closed amid $160 million in budget cutbacks over the last 3 years. The closures have led to the early release of more than 12,000 inmates. Just to meet Bob's staffing recommendations for Men's Central, Sheriff Baca said, what would require 600 to 800 more deputies at a cost of about $80 million. Where is the board going to find $80 million, he asked. Supervisor Mike Antonovich said he hoped the Sheriff's Department would implement some of Bob's recommendations, and he said the report would trigger a review of what to do with Men's Central. I don't know if it has to be torn down, but that ought to be examined along with renovating it, Antonovich said. You have to look at all options. He said his colleagues had taken Bob's report to heart. 2 months ago, Antonovich said the report prompted the board to ask the sheriff and the county's chief administrative officer to find a way to reopen the Sybil Brand Institute for Women in Monterey Park, which could house 2,300 inmates. Antonovich has also pressed to allocate enough money to move the 1,823 female inmates in the maximum security Twin Towers, which currently houses both men and women, to a less secure facility in Linwood that is empty. That would allow hardcore inmates at Men Central to move to the newer Twin Towers where they could be better monitored. Closure, not valuable. Supervisor Yvonne Brathwaite-Burke argued that such a step would help improve security at Men Central, but she said it is not viable in the near future to consider closing the jail. Investigators working for Bob spent days and nights in the jail talking to inmates and deputies, finding numerous instances of low and medium risk inmates housed in cells with dangerous ones. Even after the murders in Men's Central, two of the accused killers were mishandled by jail officials. And this is where it gets a little scary here, folks. After Santiago Pinata allegedly murdered another inmate, he remained classified at a danger level of 7 out of 9 in a system requiring the killers receive the highest classification. In addition, Bob said, county investigators discovered that Jonathan Newhall was not isolated from other inmates, even after being accused of murdering one. Many of the jail's problems stem from its design. Built in two phases during the 60s and 70s, cells are arranged in long corridors and can only be watched if deputies walk the corridors to peer inside each cell. More modern jails like Twin Towers across the street are built with cells around a control booth that allow deputies to monitor each cell from the booth. An enormous concrete building, Men's Central is a labyrinth of corridors, rows of cells and metal gates, a maze that only veteran inmates and deputies can easily negotiate. Garbage bags and sheets hang from cell doors, obstructing the view. Shouts, curses, and clanging doors echo through the facility, which is penetrated here and there by a few shafts of sunlight. The jail houses many defendants, including the county's most violent inmates, awaiting resolution of their cases. Currently, 596 are charged with murder or attempted murder. Wow. This is a one-of-a-kind jail in terms of size. We're going into the last two paragraphs here, folks, last two or three paragraphs. This is what, in a very small paragraph. This is a one-of-a-kind jail in terms of size and the number of people moving back and forward from court, said Michael Janaco, head of the County Office of Independent Review, which also monitors the Sheriff's Department for the Board of Supervisors. It is phenomenal. There hasn't been another murder there. Sheriff's officials said it was almost impossible to prevent violence while moving thousands of inmates in and out of jails every day. In Men's Central, deputies should walk the corridors day and night, Bob wrote. He recommended that the staff ratio be increased to one guard for every four, or at most five inmates. When inmates know they are not being watched or are being watched just once every hour, Bob wrote, they will take advantage of the situation by manufacturing jailhouse liquor or other contraband, extorting other inmates, or physically abusing their cellmates. Quote unquote. End of paragraph. Yeah, I finished that. I was going to finish it next week. LA County Jail is a mess. And I thought, you know, they just built a brand new state-of-the-art jail out here in Los Angeles. And the sad thing about the LA County Jail, it's in downtown Los Angeles. And no matter what happens, if you get even arrested for it, if you're a person who has never been in jail in your life, you're like the nerdiest guy in the world, and you're arrested for a traffic warrant, they're going to put you in there with some of the most hardened murderers in the county, and that needs to be separated. You know, it needs to be, and situations have happened where that has happened and people have died. About 5 or 6 years ago, I remember reading where this really tall guy was beat to death because he was like really a passive type guy, and he was, you know, but just because he was big and tall and black, I guess they put him on a jail row with a lot of the gang members, and they beat him up and killed him. They said he was a big sissy or something, and they beat him up, beat him to death, threw him off of a railing. And that has to stop. So anyway, that was from the LA Times. It was yesterday, the 3rd, February 3rd, 2002. But it'll probably be never be corrected. So listen, let's go into a little Mumia Abu-Jamal. And then we're going to end the show with a little teaser. I'm going to tease you guys with a great interview with James Brown and his wife. Yes, the godfather of soul, James Brown. I'm just going to play a little bit of it, and then I'm going to play the rest probably this Monday night on my jazz show. I do a jazz show every Monday night here at Kill Radio at midnight. The older jazz. I teach. I try and teach. Okay, this is Hassan on the 6 p.m. news, Friday news. Give us a call, 213-252-0998. It's Kill Radio Studios on this beautiful Friday early evening here in Los Angeles, right in the middle of winter, 2005. Valentine's Day is what, next week? So let's go into, let's see. Oh, I got to put Mumia on, you guys. I didn't put Mumia in the CD. I'm sorry. Okay, and again, this is killradio.org. Give us a call, 213-252-0998. Okay, let's see if I can bring Brother Mumia up. This is a new CD. Just got it in the mail yesterday from Prison Radio up in San Francisco. Let's see what they're talking about.
Liberty and tyranny. It is virtually impossible for one to sit through the meandering imperial blatherings of President George W. Bush and not hear, in the ears of the mind, the words of George Orwell, the great British writer who wrote the pivotal political novel of the 20th century, 1984. Almost with every ghost-written presidential phrase, its inner echo, like an interpreter speaking in another language in the halls of the United Nations, could be heard its Orwellian meanings. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength. It is impossible for African Americans, and certainly Native Americans, and millions of Americans who actually know something about what American history really is, to hear words like freedom, liberty, and tyranny without flinching. For many of us know that those words, while sweet to the ear, turn to ashes on the tongue when one examines real, lived experience. This was so from the earliest days of the American Republic. Indeed, at the time of the American Revolution, the brilliant British author and scholar Dr. Samuel Johnson asked with biting wit, "How is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty among the drivers of Negroes?" For centuries, American liberty has been loudly proclaimed and written in permanent ink on parchments. But what was said and written had faint little to do with liberty. In the international realm, we often think that nations are independent and free to engage in actions as they see fit. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. Nations, like individuals, are regimented and limited by structures of power. We may not speak of it often, but that doesn't mean those structures aren't there. From Angola to Zaire, in more countries than most Americans can name, the U.S. has installed the most ruthless tyrants in memory and protected their misrule by the armed might of the empire. Soon, in days perhaps, Iraq will have elections. But will it have democracy? Will Iraqis be truly able to rule, or will they have to obey their imperial masters in Washington? While George W. Bush was speaking about ending tyranny in our world, in that very hour, hundreds of people are being tortured in our name in distant places. Torture by subletting to the many dictatorships which are U.S. allies. Seems like the U.S. has certainly ignored their oppression. But don't worry, we were just joking. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
The Bush Regime, Part 2. The political scientist Machiavelli once said, "It is much better for a prince to be feared than loved." The second inauguration of U.S. President George W. Bush, and already the rumors of war are echoing throughout the halls of Washington, through the cracked walls of the Pentagon, and from the well-sourced pen of the New Yorker's Seymour Hersh. According to Hersh, Bush administration officials in the Defense Department are finalizing plans to strike a series of targets in the Islamic Republic of Iran, ostensibly because of reports that Iran possesses weapons-grade nuclear materials. Hirsch also reports that U.S. covert forces have been inside Iran for nearly a year, searching for good sites to paint for airstrikes. If so, then the country is on the brink of engaging in a war that'll make Iraq look like a picnic. This imminent war should surprise no one, for the recent election results have been interpreted by the administration as an endorsement of their mishandling of the Iraq war. And if it worked in Iraq, the thinking goes, why not Iran? It's almost as if the administration is saying, WMDs, we don't need no proof of no stinking WMDs. And in fact, they don't. The 2004 elections, which ratified the Iraq war as a facet of the facetious war on terror, has opened the door to what is, in actuality, a war on the world. Iran appears to be next. That's because Iraq was preordained for U.S. attack based upon the Project for a New American Century, a blueprint of the neocon faction of the American right wing. It is from this project that the idea of preemptive war arises. Its basic thrust is that no nation will be allowed to acquire weapons that may constitute a threat, and no nation will ever be allowed to rival the U.S. empire. Prepare for a wave of press reports about the imminent threat posed by the mullahs in Tehran. Perhaps that they paid Osama bin Laden to hit the Twin Towers and the Pentagon on September 11, 2001. Or that good old standby, democracy. I can already hear it. We're bringing democracy to the oppressed Iranians. Can't you already hear it? And once again, American imperial mania will have driven people into desperate straits, into the treacherous embrace of war. Prepare for it is coming as surely as the dawn. The empire needs to feed on blood. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Henry.
What is here, Emils?
You're good. Your guess is as good as mine. I mean, I really don't know. I was surprised when she...
What did you think of...
The Bush regime, part two. The political scientist Machiavelli once said, it is much better for a prince to be feared.
What did you think of the hearing and why it was canceled?
Your guess is as good as mine. I mean, I really don't know. I was surprised when she said a date. I really was. I was like, okay. You know, but I think that she was going by her regular rhythms, right, and set a date, and somebody got with her. Like, what the f*** are you doing? And she just as promptly unsaid it. You know, and really, I haven't read the case she cited, to be perfectly honest. But according to what Robert says and the rest of the people who have checked the case, it's bull. The case really doesn't apply. But you know, as I've always said, you know. It isn't what the law in the book says, what judges say the law is, so there you have it.
Yeah, and isn't it odd that they keep on all these decisions that the state Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court makes, they, like, aren't retroactive in this really funky way that doesn't include you.
Exactly. I mean, it's almost personal. But, I mean, you know, that's one way of looking at it. But the other thing is that, I mean, where is the logic of saying that something is unconstitutional on Tuesday, but if you did it on Monday, it's okay? And that's essentially the logic that the court has adopted for, you know, not just in my case, but for thousands of cases, you know. And it's the rule of time versus the rule of law. And, you know, if you really look at people who have had unconstitutional procedures in their cases, that number must be, you know, in the hundreds of thousands, frankly. And I'm not just talking about state cases. I'm talking about federal cases. I mean, look at the Blakely case. I mean, and look at the recent case that came down essentially affirming Blakely and invalidating the federal sentencing guidelines. Well, for people who have had that, let's say, 3 years ago or 5 years ago and have completed their appeals and been denied relief, they were essentially sentenced under unconstitutional federal guidelines. But it means nothing because they're through the system. And people who are still in the system can raise and probably
win. Your new book says that the owner of King Records, Sid Nathan, didn't want you to release this. What didn't he like about Please, Please, Please?
Well, it was repetition because I continue to say please, please, please. And he heard me say, please, please, 26 times. And didn't ever, you know, had that kind of concept or that kind of music. It was like gospel ballad, you know, and he couldn't understand the pulsating bam, 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 please, please, please. He couldn't understand that. But that was a new horizon coming by him. He totally different from what he'd heard before.
Well, I guess they made a mistake. So
I'm glad you did.
Yeah. So let's hear your first single, Please, Please, Please.
Please, 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 please.
James Brown recorded in 1956. He has a new memoir. It's called I Feel Good. Now, we've all heard your MC introduce you over the years. Why did you want an MC to introduce you in this fantastic way?
Well, because it's dramatic, it dramatizes a lot, and it's a build-up what show business should be about. Show business should really be a build-up, and then once you go into it, you like live it. But it should be a great fanfare and a production. And that gets to the people, the chords, different kind of way you say it. The same as a minister would do in the church or a coach would do to his team. You have to have a way of getting started. And that's probably the best way that I know of, with a dramatic introduction.
Did you tell him what to say?
Yes.
And one of the things your MC has always done is like, put on your cape, take off your cape. Why did you want to wear a cape?
The cape is because I saw a wrestler by the name of Gorgeous George. And Gorgeous George was a flamboyant wrestler who wore curls in his hair at that time, and he was really sharp and really different, a little early for most people. You expect him to win if he didn't win. So it was kind of a thing where he was a great wrestler, so it made great for his production. It made him quite... Gorgeous George reminds me a lot of Hulk Hogan.
The wrestler, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, have you always had your clothes made for you?
Most of the time I design them. I started wearing red suits years ago, and they thought we were crazy. But we wanted people to say, there he is, not where he is. And the same thing applied to the famous things that were working with me. Right, Tommy?
That's right.
And I do the same thing with Tommy Rhea right now. I make sure her clothes are designed different. A lot of times she don't agree with me, but that unique way and that individual look is very important. It's the same thing I have right now.
My guest is James Brown, and he has a new memoir called I Feel Good. Speaking of I Feel Good, I want to play I Got You, I Feel Good, one of your most famous songs. You have two versions of this. The first one you didn't release. You weren't happy with it. This was in 1964. What was wrong with the original version? What made you think it's not ready yet? It's not right yet?
You got to get it where it syncs with the people or where they're at. You know, I Feel Good was cut first with a jazz concept because I have a broad and a great, a more of ability to do more than one kind of music or hear one kind of thing. There are so many directions that I go in, you know. So what I did, I went back, and about 4 o'clock in the morning, I called my band leader at that time, his name was Nat Jones. I recorded I Feel Good in Chicago, and it was too sharp, too slick. It had a baritone, you know, and the syncopation was so sharp. So I had to cut something. It was like I feel good. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da and the drum. So what we did, we wanted to get more of a funk feeling, a sanctified feeling, so we changed it and slowed it down. Wow, I feel good. Now, that's two different kind of things, see? That's the one is jazz because sharp mixes, and the other one is kind of laid back. And it gave you a little rock and roll feeling at that time as well. We went with the laid-back cut because that fit the street and fit the dances. A good thing I could dance, because by being able to dance, I could really tell that the new arrangement, the new concept I had for it, really fell right in place.
Okay, everybody, this is back live here in the studio on Friday, beautiful Friday, winter Friday here in Los Angeles, and I do not see Xenophone, the next show. I don't see him out in the green room. He's probably coming up on the elevator, but I'm going to get out of here. If he's not here when I leave, I'll put on some of the pre-recorded Xenophone show. It's a great show. It comes on here on Fridays at 7 o'clock here on Kill Radio. DJ Jaime. I think that's the handle he goes under. But tune into my jazz show this Monday night, and I'll play the rest of the James Brown interview. And in the background, you're listening to Frank Morgan, saxophone player, alto saxophone player. He was a big student of Charlie Parker's. You can hear a lot of Charlie Parker riffs and Frank Morgan stuff. But I'm going to get out of here. This is killradio.org. I'm going to go get some Chinese food in downtown Los Angeles, in Chinatown. I'm off work for a couple days. It's the weekend. So I'll be back here Monday night at midnight to do straight ahead jazz and play the rest of the James Brown show here on killradio.org. And remember, Kill Radio just might save your life.